antenna range is not giving you an ambiguity. There isn't a tree out in front of the antenna giving you a reflection when you try to measure front-to-back ratio. And front-to-back ratio, by the way, is a very difficult measurement to make. If the antenna was sitting on top of a tower, where it's essentially in free space, and you've got a guy sending a signal to you from the north, and you aim your antenna to the north, and you measure the signal strength, you swing the antenna to the south, and you re-measure the signal strength, now in a realistic environment, under real working conditions, in vivo, as they say, you're now measuring real front-to-back ratio. When you properly tune the director strength and the reflector of a well-engineered Yagi, when you properly tune that, in theory, you can make the front-to-back ratio anything you want. 6 dB, 10 dB, 16 dB, 26 dB. It is possible. But now, to the catch. When you really carefully plot the pattern of an antenna with a front-to-back ratio of 26 dB, what have you got? You've got an extremely narrow notch in exactly the 180-degree point off the back of the antenna. You rock the antenna 10 degrees to the right and to the left of that, and you have nowhere near that deep a notch. So when you adjust that notch to be 16 dB down or 26 dB down, are you really doing something useful, or is it only academic? Because in either case, 10 degrees off of that, the front-to-back ratio is only 8 dB down, so to speak. So you've got a couple of questions along those lines. One of the things you could do, except for the fact that you've got these PVC pipes that are changing the coupling coefficients between the antenna elements, that's going to make modeling a little bit difficult. Except for that, the exact dimensions of your antenna can be put into a modern computer modeling program for a Yagi antenna, and all of this could be predicted ahead of time. And in the computer, you could be tweaking the positions and the length of the elements and get whatever performance you want in VSWR bandwidth, forward lobe beamwidth, forward lobe gain, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio. All of these things are acceptable if you had the right computer program. So that's one possible approach. That's one enough signal thread that you'll be able to talk over top of the sky and tell me where you stand so far. KC2OES, K2LIW in the TechNet. Try that one again, Fred.
W2L repeater system.
KC2OES, I want you to repeat that last message.
Okay, I did the north to south test as you described for front to back ratio.
Fantastic. And that's where you saw, I think you said 6 dB, is that true?
I estimate 3 to 4 S units. That's what I estimate. And so I did north-south signal from both stations, one north of me, one south of me.
Okay, 3 to 4 S units is significant. If your S meter was well calibrated, that's either 18 or 24 dB of front-to-back ratio. That's fantastic. And that's the real number. Unfortunately, many modern-day S meters don't have as good a calibration as you'd like, and therefore it may not be quite that good, but 3 or 4 S units is non-significant. That part is good. From what I can tell, you're getting very good performance there. You may have to stand by until this guy gets tired, and because he's got to be within a mile of the station in order to be doing what he's doing, we're eventually going to pin him down. Over to you, Fred, and good transmission is pretty. And we'll eventually get the rest of the information through. KC2OES, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I
pick it up. We're going to have to stand by for 2 minutes until this time gets tired. Then we'll go back to after answering your question. I'm going to take the RAW standing by. Okay, you want to give it another attempt at the next piece of information, Fred?
The PVC is only for support.
Okay. However, the PVC is simultaneously doing tuning. It turns out the tips of the elements of a Yagi are very sensitive to minor changes in If you move those pieces of PVC, I'm going to stand by for a minute. Saying is that PVC pieces of tubing do with the tip of the Yagi element, Fred, is that they're adding capacitance and changing the coupling coefficient between the elements. As those pieces of PVC tubing, I know you're using them as a support, but if you slid them up and down closer to the center of the Yagi element or closer to the tip, you're changing the tuning of the element. And you could, if you want to, use that as a tuning arrangement, or by changing the element length. If you're getting 3-4 S units of front-to-back ratio, that's an extremely good performance, assuming your S meter is doing what it's supposed to do. And as I said before, if you're getting, let me pick a number, 15 or 20 dB of front-to-back ratio, that's all you need. Anything more than that is academic, because you're just tuning the depth of the notch on the back 180-degree point, if you know what I mean. And when it comes to the overall gain of the system, it doesn't matter a whole lot. Sounds to me like you've got a darn good working antenna, One of the things I don't know about is where did the design of that antenna come from, Fred? KC2OES, K2LAW in the second half.
If you look on Ham Universe, it's N3DO, I believe, was the call sign. It's the only article that's online in reference to that antenna. But I built it a 5 element. He originally built it as a 3. He suggested a 5.
Okay, when you went from 3 to 5 elements, is there a... His original was a 3-element antenna, and you went to 5 by adding more elements. What did you do to adjust the length of all the elements? The reason I'm saying that is because one of the things that's not very well known about a Yagi is that your director string is a kind of a magnifying glass, and the magnifying glass has a certain focal length. You're trying to gather energy from a certain circle of space out in front of the antenna and focus that energy onto the driven element. Very similar to what happens with a magnifying glass on a sunny day, and you focus the sun onto a piece of newspaper and burn a hole into it. So when you make a Yagi longer, when you go from 3 to 5 elements, in theory, if you want maximum performance, you have to adjust the length of all the elements a little bit. I wonder how you went about doing that one, now, Fred. Go ahead.
The original calculation for this design was 16 inches thick, reflector-driven director, and
node number 4478, link active.
Others are all 14A.
So once again, the original design had how many elements, and you modify the design by what procedure? I guess I didn't hear that one yet, Fred. Go ahead.
There was a 3-element, 16-inch spacing between the reflector and the driven, 16 between the reflector and driven were 16, director to driven was 16. When I went to 5 elements, it became 18 inches between the driven and the reflector, 14 inches between the director.
What you said, you said it became dimensions between those elements. How did you select those new dimensions, Fred? Go ahead. How did you select those new
modeling program?
So the modeling program allowed you to... Very good. Okay, you did use a modeling program already. It's beginning to sound like you're getting most of the performance you have requested out of that antenna, as I see it, Fred. So, I think you're not sure that it was giving you the performance you desire, and you're slowly concluding, and I think I'm concluding, that it's doing pretty much what you desire. What more would you like to have it do, Fred? Go ahead.
Nothing at the moment. I do notice a big difference in it, though, comparing it with before.
Okay, you notice a big difference on what was that again?
Hitting repeaters I could not hit before.
Okay, so you're hitting repeaters you could not hit before. You're getting 3 or 4 S units of front-to-back ratio, and you're getting a reasonable standing wave ratio. Hey, Fred, you're there. I think that's doing what it's supposed to do. A very pretty looking antenna, very sturdy design, a little heavier than it has to be because you've used copper tubing, a little heavier than it has to be. One of the things that not many people know about when it comes to Yagi designs is that what is a Yagi? It is a number of parasitic elements that have the right electrical center frequency, and each of those parasitic elements has the right position in space. And whether you make those elements out of copper tubing, aluminum tubing, welding rod, or whatever, it's usually academic and mechanical. Yeah, as you use heavier items, you can have a hawk sitting on the antenna and he's not going to damage it, so to speak. But making the elements thicker and heavier doesn't change the performance a whole lot until you take it to an extreme. Well, that's one of the areas I've been involved in when it comes to UHF and SHF antennas. When you make the elements super wide, you do get some extra performance in bandwidth. Not extra gain, extra bandwidth of low standing wave ratio, which is not what you're looking for per se. In your case, you're getting a 1.4 and a 1.6 VSWR at the tips of the band. You've got it made. Sounds like a fun antenna. How many feet are you mounting it in the air, and what's the longest distance to a repeater you've talked to so far, Fred? Go ahead.
26 feet, Paris Hill, Pennsylvania.
Well done. Okay. How can you not be happy with that antenna, Fred? Go ahead.
I'm very happy with it. I would like to do some more, you know, testing kind of project kind of thing, just to see what it can do yet.
Okay, Yagi antennas are a fun project because there's no one design, whether you're speaking mechanically or electronically. And so you have the resources to make an even bigger antenna if you wanted to, even with more gain. As you're slowly discovering, the gain of the antenna is where it really happens. You can have a gold-plated transmitter, receiver, and feed line. If you don't connect it to a reasonable antenna on 2 meters and above, at a reasonable altitude to clear the trees and the local terrain and houses and buildings and whatever, you don't get a hell of a lot of performance. But once you've got some altitude and enough gain out of the antenna, VHF DXing can be kind of fun. Just wait until you discover ways of rotating the antenna to make it horizontally polarized, which will give you a little bit more advantage if you decide to talk to the single sideband people down at 144-200, or when you start building a 432 meg version of it. Now, as I see it, your antenna already has a boom that supports the elements. I guess I'm a little bit curious as to what the pieces of PVC pipe are doing at the bottom of each of the elements. Back to you on that one, Fred.
Basically what it does is redirects the load distribution from the extra two elements that are hanging out on the director end back to the mass structure, basically, is what it does. If you see the photo and look at the diagonal little brace that's at the mass connection point, you'll see why.
Okay, so you did that for mechanical reasons, and it makes it a very sturdy antenna. I have reason to believe that antenna would have no trouble surviving Hurricane Gloria, or maybe even Hurricane Katrina. What do you think?
Welcome to W2EL repeater. Good evening. Time is 9:19 p.m.
I may have a chance to do that. I'm currently using an Armstrong. It weighs just over 6 pounds, by the way.
Not bad at all. And so, if you wanted to build a 15-element version of it on 2 meters, it would start getting a little bit weighty. But when it comes to making a big antenna, long boom, strong, and whatever, you're doing it by the direct approach of using copper tubing, sturdy stuff, and PVC pipe support. Direct mechanical engineering, strong approach. Another approach that some guys have used is the so-called King Post approach. In other words, they use thin wall, large diameter tubing, a little bit more flimsy, but they use guy wire to go from the mast going a little bit above the boom, and then wires going forward and aft to stop the droop of the boom. And some guys even use insulated guy wires off to the side to stop the side sway of the boom. So whether you do it by the guying approach or the direct approach of making the materials themselves strong, which is the approach you've taken, it's your choice. You end up with a little bit more wind load in your approach. 6 pounds is not much for an antenna, and so it'll do the job very nicely. Have you thought about rotating it in polarization to talk to the sideband people? Back to you, Fred.
I don't think it would be possible based on the J-pole. I'd have to mechanically figure that one out, how to do that.
I agree. It would be a little bit difficult. However, there's nothing magic about the way you feed the driven element. You've chosen to feed the driven element in a J-pole-like manner. You can also feed it as a delta match, gamma match, T match. There's a zillion ways of feeding the driven element. A Yagi, as I said before, is a number of parasitic elements where each parasitic element has a certain resonant frequency and a certain position in space. The driven element only has to give you a good impedance match to your feed line and radiate in a dipole-like manner, and the rest of the antenna will fly. So you can take anybody's design of an antenna and put in your favorite driven element if you decide to do so. And you're not changing the design when you do it, even though you think you are. There are lots of people who think that if I change the driven element from a gamma match to a T match to a the J-pole match or whatever, then I'm changing the pattern of the antenna. Most likely you're not doing that. Because, as I said, all the driven element has to do is good impedance match, not too much balancing mismatch where a lot of RF current is flowing down the outside of the coax cable and radiate like a dipole and the rest of it will fly. So, you've got lots of capability there. Let us know on your further developments on this one. Have any further questions or comments you want to make, Fred, go right ahead. KC2OES, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, thank you very much. You just gave me an idea. The light bulb went off. I'll probably change it, do it horizontally with the gamma match. I can also change the attachment point for the boom also to redistribute the weight to get the structure out.
And a guy with mechanical smarts like you could also put some kind of a rotating system in there so the antenna can be flipped from vertical polarization to horizontal polarization, and then you can talk to both groups of people at maximum performance. The antenna you're listening to right now on my 100 feet of tower is a 13 element 2 meter Yagi, or is it 14 element? It's a Cushcraft thing. But it's mounted at a 45 degree angle of polarization. In other words, I twisted the boom, rotated around the boom so that I'm halfway between horizontal and vertical. And therefore I talk to both groups of people, but I'm 3 dB down to each because of the 45 degrees off of the vertical or 45 degrees off of the horizontal. I've done a compromise. You've got enough mechanical engineering smarts to make it a rotatable antenna and get full performance both ways. If you decide to do that, please come back and let us know about it, Fred. Fun project. Okay, the next person on my list was Rich, N2EO, and his voice is sounding stronger and stronger. How are things in Whitestone? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, TechNet, Rymark, N2EO. Yeah, I have another appointment Monday, because we don't get snow. This is both doctor, but everything is looking up. I started to realize there's a real problem. I don't know how many people realize this, with, in regard to high-power HF transmitting to. And the reason I'm bringing this up, you know, the AL-1500 that I modified to the second 8877. So when I bought that tube last March, it was pretty good price, pretty stiff, $800. And then shortly after that, IMAC raised the price to $900. And now IMAC has raised the price on the 8877 to $1,100. That's the current price for an IMAC 8877. Now what's happened is a lot of companies, while IMAC has been raising prices over the last 2 years, has switched to coming out of Russia from Svetlana. For instance, Tentec is using the GU, I think it's called the GU84, which is actually a 4CX800, which is not a triode, it's petrol. IMAC does not make a 4CX800. It's strictly a Svetlana tube, as far as I know. Tentec is using it. A number of other companies, including Alpha, switched to the GU84. And there's a company that took something in Ohio. One I know is pretty well off, which is Command Technologies. They're using the 3CX800, which is an IMAC triode. There's another company, can't think of their name, in Ohio, they're using the GU84. Now the problem comes in, I don't know if it's Mr. Putin in Russia or what, but Svetlana is no longer shipping tubes to the U.S. So all these companies are caught with their pants down, scrambling to see what they're going to do, because the only source for GU84 was Svetlana. So you can see where there's a real problem here in amateur radio, high-powered tube, or even commercial market, what you might consider medium power. So I just wanted to bring that up. Ameritron is staying with the 8877 and their AL-1500, but talking to them, they're going to have a two-tier price schedule. you can get it, but if what you'll be able to do shortly is get an AL-1500 with an IMAC tube, which is an $1,100 tube, or a Chinese tube, which is half the price. The Chinese-made 8877 for $550, your choice. But I don't know if I trust the Chinese tubes after what's been going on with taking children's toys at the center. But I don't have an answer to the problem, but I think you see where there's a real problem where companies have locked themselves into these offshore tubes, and now you can't get them.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Rich. First of all, among the VHF, UHF people, microwave people, because I'm a member of this microwave listserv, microwave respecter, Tom, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, I see a lot of people in Europe in particular talking about the use of those Svetlana tubes, and from everything I can tell, they're building lots of amplifiers with them. They're very happy, making lots of power at frequencies up to 1296 and 2300. Svetlana makes some tubes that produce a lot of power up at 1.2 and 2.4 gigahertz. So Svetlana makes some awful nice tubes. If for some reason Svetlana is not shipping tubes to the United States to commercial companies, for a guy like you with enough friends around the world, that may not be a restriction. All you've got to do is find one of your buddies in Europe that's willing to buy the tube for you and ship it to you. I guarantee you're going to get those Svetlana tubes if that's what you decide to do. If they're being sold in Europe, I guarantee hams are going to get their hands on by hook or by crook. Now, to get enough quantity to run a commercial business and to get them shipped to the United States, if that's what's going on, if there's a restriction, if there's some kind of an embargo in the United States on Svetlana tubes, I don't think that's going to stop you. It's just going to slow you down a little bit. It does sound like IMAC is pricing themselves out of business. It sounds like they don't really want to produce that tube. They wouldn't be making it that expensive. Because I can't believe they suddenly lost the recipe on the tube they've been building for a zillion years. That 8877 tube goes way back to the dark ages of the pack rats going down to Barranquilla, Colombia, with a whole bunch of RIW-13 infiltrated Yagis, 16 of them, and running moonbounds from Barranquilla, Colombia. So what I'm getting at is that 8877 has been a tool that's been around a long time. And so IMAC must not really want to produce it, otherwise they wouldn't be raising the price, because I can't believe they suddenly lost the recipe and the yield is going down. They've got to make it that expensive. I can't believe the parts going in there have suddenly become that expensive. So I'm making guesses. They don't want to, in other words, the total number of tubes they're producing is not worth it for them. And therefore, they really want Svetlana to take it over. That's my guess as to what's going on. So I don't think it's something to lose a lot of sleep over, as I see it, Rich, because with the friends you've got, you're going to be getting whatever tube you want into your hands. On top of that, you're a smart enough guy to know how to use the tube with tender loving care, and therefore you're going to get 20 years of life or 17 years of life out of that tube. So you can sit here and worry about the fact the tube's going to die and you've got to have two spares. Once I got rid of the mistakes I was making with my 4CX250Bs on the 432 parallel kilowatt amplifier, I was running the wrong kind of screen circuit in the very beginning, and I was burning up screens when I made mistakes. Once I put in the right kind of circuit to protect the screen, from then on, for the next zillion years, the same set of 4CX250Bs just kept cranking day in and day out, as long as you don't abuse them. And I know people who have abused the daylight out of the tube with extremely high voltages and currents. As long as they're blowing enough air through the tube to keep it from overheating, it keeps right on cranking. So I think you're in better shape than you know about, Rich. M2EO, KQLIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, M2EO. Well, I'm not too worried. I mean, for myself, it's just not a healthy situation to be in where we're depending on offshore tubes, the preferred ones coming from Russia, and not being able to get them and having to deal with China. It's not something Americans are used to doing, American hands are used to doing. Maybe it's a new way, I don't know. But, I saw a protection circuit in the Air 8877, and they do work. I've tripped them a couple of times. They do trip, so I'm not too worried about it. But like I say, it's not a very good position for hands or industry to be in the United States, where you're having everything made here, everything available, the best in this country, and that's not the case
right now.
Dick, why do you think IMAC, if they don't want to make the 8877, why don't they just drop it? Why play games? I mean, it doesn't make sense. That film came out in the, it came out around 1976, I believe, or 75. The film was $200. And when it went to $400 and $600, IMAC would take your old tube and rebuild it and charge you a core charge to rebuild it. They no longer do a rebuild, and of course, like I said, it's gotten ridiculous. The other thing I'm curious about, I was discussing, and maybe he's still on frequency,
Al,
K6DTZ, we were talking about glass tubes, and 3500s are available. Not from IMAC, but they're available. Why hasn't anybody since, I would say, the 60s or 70s employed the 3-1000Z or 4-1000A? Those are powerhouses, they're glass tubes, and they're not very expensive. The last thing I know to use a 3-1000 was something put out by a company called Brad Thompson Industries. PCI-LK 2000, which was sort of like a competitor to the Henry 4 model kilowatt. It used a 3-1000, but nobody is using those tubes today. It's a big glass tube, put out tons of power, probably not going to...
Activity timeout.
Node number 4478, link clear.
Okay, I think you passed it over to me, but at the same time that the machine did an announcement, Rich. When it comes to the great big glass bottles, they're sort of out of vogue. Everybody likes the small, compact, forced air-cooled external anode tube these days. It saves you a lot of volume. So everyone's in love with small rigs that are easily fit on the desktop. That's part of what's going on. The 8877, I am guessing IMAC has not dropped it thoroughly, because it has been used in a number of military products. And my experience with the Department of Defense is that when they sign a contract to use a particular tube in a military product, their biggest fear is what they call the vanishing vendor problem. In other words, they know they're going to be restocking the equipment at some later time, refurbishing it, and if that vendor no longer exists, they're in a lot of trouble. So I am guessing IMAC had to sign a contract saying that they would continue to support that tube for X number of years. They don't like building that tube for ham radio operators because we ain't buying enough of them to make that line profitable. But they've got to keep manufacturing it because of that military contract, is my guess. Now, when it comes to Chinese tubes, don't worry so much. I'm going to wait a little.
Node number 4478. Link active.
I can always tell when the machine's about to make an announcement because it drops the audio on what I'm sending through it. When it comes to Chinese products, be careful about prejudging. The fact that there's maybe some unscrupulous people or maybe some guys that made some mistakes and they put lead-based paint in Chinese toys that are shipped to the United States doesn't mean that the Chinese make poor products in every area. One of the clients that I have is buying zillions of antennas from Taipei, Taiwan, China, and they're getting an extremely high quality product. Talk to Kent Britton of the A5DJB, and you look at those beautiful printed circuit Yagis he makes for every band from roughly 200 megs to 10 gigahertz. They are built in China, and if you've seen one, you've seen them all. The perfect cookie cutter antennas. As long as he does a good job of designing the antenna and telling them what dimensions he wants them to build, he gets exactly that product, and he gets piles of them. So the Chinese made electronic products. I have not seen any evidence of them being poor in quality. I don't have specific experience when it comes to the tubes, but from what I'm hearing, the way hams talk to each other, that hams started using Chinese tubes and the tubes gave them grief, the way we talk to each other, the word would spread around the world in milliseconds, if you know what I mean, and we'd all know to avoid certain brands and certain model numbers of tubes. So by way of Svetlana and your buddies in Europe shipping you tubes, by way of China, you've got tubes, and so I think we're in better shape than we previously worried about, Rich. That's my impression. NQEO, K2LIW in the deck, man. Go ahead, KTJJ.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Another thing that might be going on here is MIMAC has government contracts for that period. A lot of those contracts cannot sell that same product commercially for any less than what they're charging the government for. What's going on here is that Collins ran into that problem. The fact that the 6650 F line is one of the reasons why it's so expensive.
Very fine. Good explanation, Doug. By the way, Doug, your audio is 10 decibels lower than I think it should be. Beautiful signal, nice clean audio, but not enough of it. I wonder if you changed mic or is somebody sleeping in your house. So back to you, Doug.
No changes here, Doug. I'm going to talk up on it a little bit. Maybe that's better.
Now you're only 6 dB down. Somebody has changed the gain control, or your microphone has changed characteristics. Your audio is quite a bit weaker than it could be, in my opinion. From time to time, I hear people with beautiful signal but weak audio on this machine, and for reasons I don't understand, nobody mentions it to them. It's nice to fill out the carrier with all the audio you can. But yes, you've got a darn good point. Not only are they worried about vanishing vendors, but they're worried about what price they're being sold at. So I think we've got some pretty good guesses, Rich, as to what's going on there. Any further comments, Rich? Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. No, just I like the tube. It's, it's a relatively easy tube to design with. It puts out tons of power. Go on to the next person, but I just got one quick question. I'll make a comment first. The company that I understand that is selling the Chinese 8877, they take these old American companies that are out of business and have no longer have the name registered. You may remember that way back a company called Taylor Tube. Well, it's a Chinese company now, nothing to do with the old American defunct company Taylor. But Taylor Tube in China is selling the Chinese 8877s for $550, which is still a good piece of change. I just, you go on to the next person, Nick, but I'd like to know, I may give him a call, is W6PO still with IMAC, and would he be at liberty to talk about what's going on?
No.
Yeah, is he a silent key? I'm not sure about that one. And you might know that one, Doug.
K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, well, read between the lines, I don't recall it. The original IMAC Corporation, is no longer, it's now part of Variant. And what happened was, I can go back many years because I once spoke to Bill Eichel many years ago when he called me and to talk to me about the amplifier that I had built using a pair of, when they came out with a pair of, they came out with the 3CX800. And to encourage amateur radio operators to work with that tube at the time. If you bought one tube, they sold you the second one with chimney and socket for half price. When I finished it and was in Ham Radio magazine many years ago, Bill Eichel actually gave me a call and said that he was very satisfied to see what the hams were doing with it. He actually did call people who bought that setup, and I went ahead and I had, it was only one to a ham, but I got another, I got another ham to use his call letters to buy another setup like that because I wanted to
call from 3320.
When there was a ham radio operator, two ham radio operators really involved in the the CEOs of the company, it was a different story. You call them now, and boy, are they aloof, because I ran into that about 2 years ago. I won't go into it on here, but they really, you know, gave me the, that type of routine tick, like, you know, we're not going to permit nothing. I mean, you just couldn't pry anything out of them. I won't go no further, but not the same situation as it used to be, Dick, over.
You've got nice loud audio these days, Mel. You must have made a change in your system. Okay. Yep. The bean counters are dominating. The bean counters and the mergers are changing the company. IMAC used to be a beautiful ham-oriented company. Not only did they support hams by holding their hands when it comes to holding their handy when it comes to buying tubes and using them correctly, but the various members there were printing these moonbound tech notes and whatever. That was the good old days. Looks like things have changed. Okay, I'm going to go on to the next person. I think it was M2FLS. I'm not sure whether or not Mark told me he did or did not have a question, but I'm going to give him an opportunity. Maybe he's got a question after hearing all this jazz. M2 Fox Lima Sierra, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Oh, Nancy, to Fox Lima Fox. No, no, just listening, Dick. Thank you.
Very fine, Mark. Okay. And Steve, KC2MPP, I think you had a question. If not, you've got an opportunity now to ask anything you want except how to get rich quick. You got it, Steve.
No, Dick, no question. Just a quick thing as far as tubes, Dick. I hear all this talk about, you know, like a max set of tubes, you know, you got to get a max pair or a max quad set of tubes. How much truth is there to that? Back to you.
There's at least two different answers on that one. If the two tubes are going into a push-pull circuit, and if you're trying to tune the rig for best third-order intermodulation distortion, then I'm reasonably sure there's merit in making a matched set of tubes. If you're taking unmatched tubes and put them into a parallel kilowatt amplifier, like that strip line thing that I wrote an article on in April and May issue of QST way back in 1972, 432 megacycle transmitter, because the two tubes are running on the exact same voltage at the exact same instant of time, absolutely positively, no matching is required. In fact, I ran an experiment where I would turn the filament off of one of the two tubes, and I would slowly let one tube go dead as I retuned the rig. And I got half power output, the same amount of gain, and the same harmonic content and efficiency, and probably the same intermod, although I didn't measure the intermod. So when you've got a parallel circuit, and modern-day circuits tend to run parallel, why have all the extra rigmarole and circuitry for push-pull? When the two circuits are running in parallel, and therefore it's an equipotential surface between the two, and both tubes are having forced to have the exact same voltage on them, no longer is matching required, in my opinion. If one tube can draw more current than the other, let it do so. That's the combination, because that tube has got a higher pervium. That's the combination that will give you more power output from that particular setup. And so I ran a bunch of experiments of putting unmatched tubes into that amplifier. So, do the tubes have to be matched? Yes and no. Depends on how you're using them, in my opinion. How about you, Steve?
Take to Kate, why would another comment?
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, take for instance, let me give you a good for instance. We are at the point. Collins produces a nice amplifier called the 30L1. Very compact amplifier, desktop, as you say. And what they did is they took 4 8-11 in there, original design, which of course you can update if you want, put in 572. The way they tune that rig, they have a meter on it, the tuning meter on that, which is basically a multimeter that they have. That, you know, you flip it one way, you read your plate voltage, the other way, you flip tune position or to plate current. In the tune position, they have a circuit in there that when it's zero, when you adjust that amplifier, you want that amplifier adjusted to optimum. You just maneuver the two adjustment knobs on there to read zero. When the meter reads, that's about a quarter way up the meter, there's a zero point. And you can see you're approaching it either side. In other words, you know, positive or negative at that point.
If the tubes are not matched, that circuit don't work.
I have tried that. I've looked into it. So in that case, in a case like that, you must use matched tubes. Otherwise, the circuits don't work. And even a bulletin that came out with on column 30L1, they also stressed that. So it depends on, you know, the application. But in the case of four tubes, you have a situation. That's why you see that there's a couple of companies that are selling tubes, or, you know, a set of tubes for the Kong 30L1 linear that they specify. They are matching pairs, Dick, over.
Okay, when the tubes are unmatched, Mel, and therefore that balancing circuit is going to show you a lot of unbalance. So the balancing circuit, whether it be current, power output, or whatever, screen current, and so on, shows an imbalance. However, when you run the tubes in balance, what happened to the output? Was it distorted? Was it lower power? What was the real output under those conditions, if you happen to know, Mel? Go ahead.
Now, I looked at, you know, I had it into a dummy load and watched the first watt meter and all that, and I also said to myself, how much difference does it make? It's a bunch of height, you know, right? A lot of things to me is height. And I didn't see anything really other than, like I say, got a diddle with a little bit that's too, you know, prudent. But other than that, I didn't see anything really here that you would say, oh boy, what a difference. In fact, even putting what they touted a couple of the articles for putting, replacing the 811s with 572s, I didn't see any big difference in that situation. I just think over.
That's sort of what I expected. So, for the academician who really likes everything to be balanced because he thinks it's required, particularly in a push-pull circuit, in some cases where you're trying to reject the third or the fifth order intermodulation distortion, I can see that there would be some advantage in balancing. But when it comes to parallel circuits, I'm skeptical, as you can tell. So, I don't think so. It looks to me like if you've got a set of tubes that are unbalanced and the amplifier is giving you reasonable power output and it's not smoking, I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it, as I see it. So those are some of my comments on that one, Steve. Harry, WB2H, I'm not sure that you had a question, but I'm going to give you an opportunity. You got it, Harry. And Bill, QGZ, he's a guy who's always listening. And boy, does he know about dongles and RFID devices. What's the latest in your neighborhood there, Bill? WB2QGZ, if you're there, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, not a lot. Just running back and forth in that room. You caught me in a good moment. just fooling around a little bit with a couple of antennas for FM satellite use. And what I'm working on here is something that came from the Civil Technology Club. Something that the fellows out there were working on, and they made a little presentation about a little bit, a week or so ago. Maybe a turnstile for VHF with a moxon on top of it, maybe on a single mast if I can stack them vertically to try to avoid a lot of descent. Not sure if that'll work, but just getting some pieces together and parts and trying to see if I can get that cooking. Okay.
Yeah, next time you go out there, give me a shout on the phone on the Twisted Pair. I'd like to see what you're involved in. See, there's another comment I had to you.
Good.
Forgotten it. Oh, yes. I have in my possession a beautiful nylon case that's going to go to you. I think you know where it came from. And I think it's also got a plastic case inside that will hold some very nice bars. So I've got a prize for you. Make sure you and I meet each other. And if you have any more of your prizes for me, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you, Bill.
There you go. Excellent. Well, the pizza's on me as well. I located one more, and I just got to pick it up Monday, Tuesday. It just came to my attention last week, so I'll get on that and I'll give you a holler.
Fantastic. I'm also, what I've literally done is a buddy of mine down in Texas purchased for me 716 DIN connectors with lightning protectors on them that got pulled out of you-know-what service, and so it's going to be fun to test those. Because nowadays I can look down 165 dB. Wow. All right. Boy, do I see things when I do that. All right, Bill.
Thank you for all that information. Let's see. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. Let me stand by for a second to make sure I didn't skip anybody. If not, we're going to go over to Paul and find out what's going on in space. Did I skip anybody by mistake?
Dick, K2JJ again.
Go right ahead, Doug.
I just wonder if there's any difference in the audio on this microphone.
Your audio now is just about identical to my audio. It's better than mine, but it's identical in volume to my audio. Back to you, Doug.
Okay. Had a dirty connector, I guess. Very good. Well, carry on. Let's see what's going on in the space. K2JJ.
Here we go, Dick. I had a quick comment for Mel.
Okay, Rich. Yeah. Now we can hear all those tones very nicely. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Mel, last week I heard you say you had a homebrew tuner, I think, with a different values, active variable, and a low inductor. Take a look at the PALSTAR 1810K. I've got one here, which is a 2,000 picofarad vacuum variable. I believe it's a 28 microhenry lower inductor, wound with like number 8 wire. It's a monstrous tuner, but it's quite a nice piece of work, Bill.
Okay, thank you, Rich. This is KEY. Yeah, basically that's what I have. As I said, I put quite a bit of resources into building that tuner. And by the way, what I did to match it, actually I used it on the S line, Collins S line. So I purchased a cabinet that matches the S line, so it fits right in. Looks like everybody says to me, "What?" I know other visitors that are knowledgeable in Collins line said, "What Collins tuner was that? They never saw one like that." And I said, "Uh-huh." I said, "That was a special production." Match the panel, everything, and put that tuner together. But I put a lot of resources into it with vacuum variables and silver plated rotary inductor, and on and on and on and on. But in fact, one of the most priciest things was buying a Bird simultaneous two plug differential coupling system, where you put two plugs in, one way, one the other way, they simultaneously can read out either on 2 meters, on two separate meters if you want, which I, I have the two separate meters. I used to have that, and I didn't have it in a panel. I have it as an external because of where the tuner is located. So what I have is a cable, but on a switch I just flip back and forth, but I don't have to turn, in other words, plug around. That is a very costly device, but something I guess you don't see very much, Dick, over.
Fantastic. Hey, Mel, next June, when you and I have an eyeball, you're going to have to show me a little bit of the Schneider Museum. My goodness, you have some fancy stuff. Go ahead.
It's about a $500 unit, Dick.
Yeah, of course. That's what I said. Next time we get together, we'll some things we just won't maybe sit around there and but yeah, it was nice there, Tick, and the food was good, wasn't it? Over.
Oh yeah, that's what brings me back every year. I can trust the people anytime. That's a joke. Okay, I'm going to take you up on that. Alrighty, Paul, if you're available, what's going on in space? Bring us up to speed. WSQN, if you're there, keep your RIW in the tech net. I was pretty sure Paul signed it, but looks like we don't get to him early enough, and he goes to sleep. He's got to get up early in the morning. He's not like us retired folks, Mel. Now, Mel, have you seen the February issue of QST Magazine, which I got on Saturday? And it's got on, what page is it now? Okay, on page 74, hands-on radio, experiment number 61, Smith chart, fund number 3. Beautiful article on Smith chart. If you haven't already seen it, you're going to jump up and down with enthusiasm. Nicely illustrated, gives you some beautiful other ways of using it. Wonder if you've seen that, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. No, I don't get QST. Somebody in the, I'm sure. You know, it's funny. The mailman mentioned to me one day last week, we're talking, and he says, you use that antenna, that big antenna you have? He says, I always look at it. Do you use it a lot? I told him about, you know, I started telling him about all the things I do with ham radio and all. And he seems to have an interest in it, and I think besides him, there's somebody else in the post office there that has an interest in radio, ham radio, or whatever. So I know that I think sometimes I think the magazine looks like it's in some room, so I get it late. I most likely won't get it until sometime next week, Dick. And, as I was saying to you, with, you know, things like making things yourself and all, it's pleasurable, and a lot of people will say to you about it, but you're spending so much more money, and it's not going to have a heck of a lot of resale value. But I don't build these things. I don't do these things for resale value. I can easily, I'm sure, go out if I want something and be able to purchase it at this time in life. But, you know, I try to instill this in a lot of the young people that I meet, you know, new hams and all. Try making something, you know. You'll see how much satisfaction. Don't become complacent just as a client operator. But it's a hard sell, Dick, over.
Yes, it is. We live in a throwaway society. Say, for instance, the rotator mechanism is giving me a little bit of grief in my microwave oven. And a lot of people will simply throw out the microwave oven, even though the little set of wheels that go under the tray that rotates a piece of plastic to dry it out. And I'm going to either make a substitute or replace it. The rest of the microwave oven is serving me very well for the last 20 years, and why change it, as far as I'm concerned? But you and I like repairing things. We take pride in that. I hold on to an automobile until the wheels fall off, and it's a little bit ridiculous at times. But it's just the way it's just my lifestyle. I can easily afford another car, but don't get around to doing it. The latest issue, when your post office finally finishes reading it, it's got a nice article about lightning and lightning protection. It's got a nice Smith chart article. It's got a nice article in the World About 50 Meg on the subject of the current sunspot cycles and past sunspot cycles. Lots of evidence that we just hit bottom on this one. And some predictions about what the next one's going to be. Nice article about the evolution of Yagi antennas and how they were developed. So some pretty good articles, and you'll get a kick out of it when you finally get it. I bet you've gotten some mail, and I bet you've probably done a few experiments this week. So you can discuss the mail, you can discuss the experiments, or whatever. KQKEY, KQRIW in the TechNet. Mel is the co-moderator, as you guys know. You got a mail.
Okay, very good. This is KQKEY. Oh, yeah, I get mail. Let me look at some of them. I didn't even get a chance really to look at much of this stuff. It's usually at the last minute that I really pull. And because, like you, you know, it's, as my friend says, oh, he says, you're unsuccessfully retired. That's the way he says they put us back to the category. I bet you didn't do that, the category, Dick, over.
I've heard various people complain about the fact that a lot of people who are interested in their business, when they retire, they don't really retire. I used to work five days a week. Now I work 6 days a week. But I only work half days now that I'm so-called retired, or semi-retired, as I call it. I call it semi-retired. However, you may have seen some of the statistics which seem to suggest that a high percentage of people that thoroughly retire have passed away within 5 years. And so you and I don't really retire, so hopefully we're going to hang around a little longer. You got it, Mel.
Okay. Roger. Okay, I'll consider myself unsuccessfully retired. Anyhow, I'm just reading through, you know, just making chit-chat while I read through some of this. Here, we got a number of these different of the comments on this last week. If you remember, I mentioned using power supplies from computers. And I got an, oh, thank you very much. I now have a number of spare power supplies to run my different radios and all. I did exactly what you did, and, oh, it worked out terrific. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work, you two guys. Okay. Another one here even mentioned briefly that